Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
30 years ago this week, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. The ADA prohibits discrimination based on disability, making it one of the most influential pieces of civil rights legislation since the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
For too many Americans, the blessings of liberty have been limited or even denied. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 took a bold step towards righting that wrong, but the stark fact remained that people with disabilities were still victims of segregation and discrimination, and this was intolerable.
30 years later, in the midst of a global economic upheaval and a global pandemic, where are we on disability rights and equality? And what are the next frontiers? Joining us now to discuss this and to reflect on the 30th is Cortland Towns III, Deputy Director of the Boston Center for Independent Living, the nation's second ever independent living center. Cortland, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Sherry Blowett. She's a sports medicine specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she directs the Kelly Adaptive Sports Research Institute. She's a two-time winner of the wheelchair division of the Boston Marathon. Dr. Blowett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So we have an ADA generation now. We have 30 years of people living with this act in place. So let's just start, remind all of us of its impact on our lived world, on our workplaces, our families.
Sure. I mean, right now, because of the ADA, there's real access, you know, real access to schools, jobs, transportation, sidewalks. I mean, it's easy for folks to forget that there was a time when town halls, state houses, government buildings were inaccessible. People would go to vote and would not be able to get in. There was no guarantee of ASL interpreters for the deaf and hard of hearing, no guarantee of alternative formats for people that were blind or visually impaired. Even local cities and buses and subways oftentimes were not accessible. So we're not fully there yet as far as full access and complete access for folks. But it's made a real difference. You know, children with disabilities have a right to a full and complete education, and the ADA generation kids understand that.
Yeah, I would agree, Cortland. And I think as well, you know, the ADA has ensured that people with disabilities have their basic civil rights protected, and that also have opportunities and a recourse of legal action, you know, if those civil rights aren't protected. And I think that's a very powerful thing.
Absolutely.
Has change come willingly? When the act was signed into law, did change come quickly, easily, and on which frontiers? And where has change been slow to come, even though it's codified now?
I think it was incremental, and we continued to see incremental change. Mm-hmm. For example, a lot of the changes in infrastructure that we enjoy now, things like ramps and elevators and automatic door openers, you know, those things weren't put into place overnight. So from the standpoint of physical access, change has been very incremental, and it's important to know that the ADA is more proactive than retroactive. So if you have an old building that you haven't renovated in 40 years that wasn't built under the premise or under the protection of the ADA, it probably still isn't accessible. And unless you choose to renovate it or get new permits to renovate it, you may not have to make it accessible. So really, what we really see is that new construction comes online. It comes online in a way that is accessible. So we've seen slow culture change in that regard.
For sure.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, shortly after President Bush signed the ADA into law, he also said, you know, let these shameful walls of exclusion come tumbling down. And while many of those walls have come tumbling down, there certainly continue to be many barriers. Mm-hmm. There's barriers to healthcare, yeah, barriers to affordable, accessible housing. And that's a huge one for folks with disabilities. They may be access to jobs, but folks need a place to live. And that still continues to be a huge problem, not only in Massachusetts, but across the nation.
Yeah, I'd also Let me just
ask this one, just following on specifically what the two of you were just talking about. It makes me think of the 5-year-long battle on Beacon Hill over sidewalk cutouts. The Beacon Hill Civic Association challenged that. There was a lawsuit. It took 5 years. Those cutouts weren't put in place until around May of 2019. So how do we think about those kinds of battles, given what you've just been saying?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And, you know, a lot of the battles and wins as it relates to access have been hard fought over the years. And there are still many ways in which, you know, the ADA has been very powerful and very impactful, but there are ways it's still limited. So, for example, if you have historical infrastructure that you feel wherein you feel that making it accessible would be overly onerous or change the sort of nature, historic nature of the building, then you can get an exception to the ADA and that building can stay inaccessible. And that's where there's sometimes some gray area in terms of, you know, what is historic, what isn't historic, what's required. And so the law still has some limitations. I still think there's still large swaths of Boston that are completely very much inaccessible for people with mobility disabilities. You know, I'm a wheelchair user, and when I go to Newbury Street, for example, probably only about maybe max 25% of those businesses are accessible to me. So I simply don't shop there, you know, and there are areas of our city, that's one example, but there are several others where people with disabilities are still largely excluded, which is unfortunate because people with disabilities represent a very large market. You know, on the whole, it's 20 to 25% of our population. And it's a real miss from a business standpoint for a lot of small businesses to not be accessible to the whole community.
Absolutely.
Courtland, I've heard a number of arguments over the years, the Beacon Hill case being just one, that good design, good responsiveness to the requirements of ADA, good design for people with, for example, a mobility disability, really is good for everyone. Everyone benefits from those investments. You know, as Dr. Blowett just said, you know, you improve your customer base, et cetera. So what do able-bodied listeners misunderstand about the ADA, about disability protections, about investments in disability accessibility that people need to understand?
Well, I mean, I think folks have to look at, I mean, the disability community is broad, okay? There's many, many different kinds of disabilities, and not all of them are mobility related. But the family of people with disabilities is one that you could join at any time. So there may be accessibility features that you may not need now, but that you may need later as a result of a change in your functional ability, whether it be from age, from a motor vehicle accident, from a stroke, or anything else. So if you look back at the concept that was once kind of a hot topic of like livable communities, people can understand that curb cuts don't just assist folks with disabilities who may be using a wheelchair, but also mothers with strollers, people that are pulling a shopping cart as they're going to the laundry. You know, elevators aren't just for people who aren't able to ambulate, but it's also good for elders and people carrying packages. So, I mean, the argument of aesthetics, well, because this is historic and we like the cobblestones, aesthetics over accessibility has never been a valid argument for me. So if we really want to have an accessible society and access to the American dream for everyone, then the communities themselves have to be not only physically accessible, but also programmatically accessible.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Blowett, we're having this conversation during a global pandemic. The coronavirus is upon us. We've reported on this show racial disparities that are being laid bare by the pandemic in our healthcare system, how vulnerable populations are disproportionately vulnerable to the pandemic. I know these disparities aren't new, but how are they intersecting with the disability community during this coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this important point. You know, really what we've seen is that the pandemic has laid bare many gaps and disparities to health in access to healthcare that prominently impact the disabled community, you know, similar to parallels we've seen as it relates to the Black community and people of color. I think some key examples of that, you know, for so many years, our healthcare system and the way we run our services has put up barriers to people living independently in the community. You know, it is easier for us in this country to institutionalize someone in a nursing home rather than to support them to live in their home, even though it's actually more cost effective to keep people in their home. It, of course, promotes empowerment and independence, and it's what people want. But because we've established and really promoted this context of nursing home care as a primary means of care across our communities, we've now seen a really devastating impact on our nursing home communities, which of course is primarily people with disabilities. Of course, there's also intersectionality here in that people with disabilities of color or people with disabilities who are poor are also more likely to live in institutionalized environments. So we've really seen this confluence of, you know, how we've established our infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure over the last several decades, unfortunately predispose people with disabilities to being at much higher risk for acquiring the coronavirus or COVID-19. And of course, then being at higher risk for poor outcomes related to COVID-19. I'd say a couple of other major gaps that we've seen is that, you know, we've not done a good job historically in integrating data collection about disability within our broader healthcare infrastructure. There's been some recent progress around elements of race, ethnicity, preferred language, et cetera, but disability data is not collected. That makes it very difficult for us to know how the community is being impacted, whether or not there are disparities and gaps in things like testing for people with disabilities, whether people with disabilities are dying at a higher rate. You know, I think the answer is fairly intuitive, but frankly, it's not data driven. And that's a big gap, because data is what drives policy and drives funding. And that's something that we need to fix into the future.
And so I think Courtland, with that in mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, we have a delay. Of course, we're all in three different places due to the virus that we're talking about right now. Go ahead and add your point there.
No, I mean, as far as if you want some concrete data, like right now in Massachusetts, we have over 32,000 people that are living in nursing homes, right? Mm-hmm. And it's estimated that at least 10,000 of those people could be living in their own homes with the proper supports. So the Olmstead decision of 99 ruled that unjustified segregation of people with disabilities did in fact discriminate because it violates the ADA. And we all know that stable housing is one of the key determinants of health, right? But if you look at in this pandemic, as for the COVID-19, the highest death tolls, over 40% are amongst people living and working in nursing homes. That's over 45,000 people that have expired nationwide and over 5,300 people here in Massachusetts alone. And folks with disabilities are definitely represented amongst those with underlying medical conditions. So, you know, if you want to talk about, again, real integration, we have to be able to move folks out of nursing homes where they're more at risk, out of these institutional facilities, and move into the community where they can live independently, access the American dream, live it fully. You know, folks need some supports, you know, personal care attendants, supported living. There's a variety of them. But the key for our state really is a lack of affordable and accessible housing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have about 2 minutes left. And I want to ask you both just briefly from each of you, if there were an ADA 2.0 law to come forward today, what would be key provisions you'd want to see?
Good question. Well, you know, I'd say I think some key points for progress into the future. You know, I think that that policy change and legislation and laws can change infrastructure, and we've seen some impact there. But laws don't necessarily change culture. And so I think when we think to the future of what could have the biggest impact, we still have a lot of work to do as it relates to reducing our cultural bias and stigma around disability, understanding that disability is something that impacts, frankly, nearly everyone at some point in life. And that when we think about inclusive services, we need to understand that it's not just for a small subset of people in our society, but it's actually for everyone. So I would probably try to tackle it from the standpoint of thinking of how we can continue to make progress as it relates to things like the built infrastructure, things like accessibility and communication, things like closed captioning and accessible websites. But how do we really get at the cultural change to reducing stigma around disability and understanding that it's not a lesser way of living or something that needs to be devalued, but actually part of the ubiquitous life experience that we all face?
Thank Agreed. You for that. Courtland, I have about a half a minute left, please.
Again, I'd say education and enforcement. A law is only as good as it is enforced. And I think education about some of the things that we just talked about, you know, disability rights is human rights. Disability rights is civil rights. It needs to be taught in school. People need to understand how we got to where we are now. You know, it was a bipartisan move to pass the ADA, but it wasn't because there was some benevolent feeling. Folks worked and fought for it.
And that is Cortland Towns III, Deputy Director of the Boston Center for Independent Living, and Dr. Sherry Blauett, a sports medicine specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thanks to both of you for joining us to mark the anniversary this week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tatiana.